Coming up today, NASA's next adventure, Facebook's moderators, and a new dawn for an old phone. You're listening to episode 319 of the YGK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Matt Burgess.
Hey.
And Vicky Wollaston.
Hello.
You all survived in my accident. Hey there.
Hey.
He's wearing shorts as well.
It's a sunny day.
Not in this cupboard. It is never sunny in this cupboard. It's very warm. So we're going to try and keep our sanity this week, I hope.
I'm not promising anything.
I listened last week. A thing you learned. Vicky, we'll start with you.
So this has caused a little bit of controversy because I'm not entirely sure whether it's an accurate fact or not. But apparently you could eat the stickers that come on fruit.
What, like the ones that are on apples and bananas?
And pears and things like that, yeah. So I wouldn't eat a sticker that's on a banana because then you'd have to eat the banana peel and that's just weird, Burgess.
Yep. Yeah, that is weird.
I'm not worried.
I mean, I suppose technically you can eat anything.
I guess.
So, yeah. I'm not sure if it'd be recommended. They've got glue on them. Are you meant to eat glue?
So apparently the glue is FDA approved. And it's not encouraging you to eat the stickers. Mm. It's basically if you accidentally eat a sticker or you can't spare the 2 seconds to peel it off or yep. you cook it into something, it will be okay. But I put this on Twitter thinking that everyone knew this and I was coming late to the party. And then loads of people replied and said, I didn't know this. I'm not sure that's true.
This is very surprising news.
So if it is true, my mind is blown. If it's not true, I'm sorry about the fake news.
Well, I've recently started eating the whole apple, the core and all.
You've become my granddad.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? It's a perfectly good apple.
Next you'll be eating the whole banana.
I will. I'll let you know how that goes. What did you learn this week, Matt?
I learned something, but I'm going to make you guess what it is. No, I'm going to give you a little bit more information.
Something to do with dogs.
No, I'll give you a little bit more information. It's nothing to do with a dog. It's to do with balloons.
Go on then, go.
The world's biggest balloon sculpture was made in 2012 by a person called Lily Tan, and it was a giant robot called Sentinel, or it looked like a robot. It wasn't actually a robot because it was made of balloons. It was 19 meters high. It took 50 people 42 hours to make. How many balloons were harmed or used?
How many balloons were used in the making of this robot?
Of Sentinel.
Mickey?
98,000.
that went from one extreme to the other.
Lower than that. 726.
Oh, you're miles off. It's 79,854.
Oh,
so Victoria
Wollaston. That's actually quite close.
Yeah. It took a long time, 42 hours. I assume that was blowing balloons up and then tying them all together. I don't know what they did with it afterwards. Maybe it blew away.
I guess
away
it just deflated eventually, didn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
oh,
blew away
RIP
in the wind.
Sentinel.
James, have you learned anything?
Not especially. Well, in fact, I've sort of. I learned that you can now watch live TV on planes.
Really?
I didn't think this was a thing, but you can.
What did you watch?
Limited choice, but I watched Real Madrid versus Atletico Madrid, the second leg, while I should have been sleeping on a flight but couldn't sleep, so I could watch live football.
That is pretty cool, actually.
It's the future. Yeah. So, in keeping with that, just to give it a bit of a plug, I was flying a very long way to go to Japan, and as Vicky mentioned last week, I saw a few robots. We had Meiti, the retail assistant robot, but another one that it's worth mentioning. So this was a little glimpse inside some of the research and development that Fujitsu does, and as well as this kind of slightly creepy robot that slides up and down shop aisles at night, making sure that all the cornflakes are in the right place. They also have this far cuter one that you might have stationed around airports that waves at you and points you in the right direction and in Japanese style bows and is very polite.
Aww.
Robots.
Yeah.
I mean, they were everywhere.
Were any of them made of balloons?
No. In fact, this one looked a bit like Eve from Wally.
Oh, that's pretty cute.
Yeah, pretty cute indeed. I also learned about Japanese business card manners, which I had an inkling about before. But it turns out that there's a whole process that you have to go through in order to do this politely. So when giving a business card in Japan, you should hold it by the corners with both hands, being careful not to cover any of the logos or words on it so people can clearly see who you are and where you work from. And then they should take it by the other corners, examine it closely, and then say, thank you very much, your name and your company, for your business card. And then you do the same in reverse.
They're incredibly polite over in Japan, though, aren't
they? They are. And it's really quite sweet, but unless you know...
minefield.
The correct protocols. It is a little bit of a minefield. So I hope I didn't offend anyone in the way I was taking business cards.
Can we just stop a second?
Yes.
Because do you have business cards?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, if you had them and I didn't, I sort of wanted to know why I didn't
this
have a business card.
This caused a lot of confusion as well. It's like, you don't have business cards. I have Twitter. you can find me on Twitter. I think that was somewhat lost in translation. Our first story this week, we hinted at it a little bit during the introduction, and I'll hint at it again now. It's a horrible, horrible noise. Or as Jeremy put it earlier, they remixed the old Nokia ringtone with pan pipes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds
so
like.
So what phone am I holding up to help people that obviously can't see what I'm talking about?
It is the Nokia 3310.
Is it, though?
That is incredibly garish and yellow.
Yes. So this is the phone that we all came to know and love very well, what, 20 years ago?
Yep.
15 years ago? And it's kind of back. I mean, Nokia's just bought out an old phone, which it's been making for years and given it the same name as a phone we're all very familiar with.
So that's the thing. So Jeremy has written a review about this, and he's actually going to be talking about it on the Gear podcast. So in addition to this weekly podcast and Roland's Upvote podcast, we're now launching a Gear podcast with Mark Walton from Ars Technica. So you can hear Jeremy wax lyrical about this phone on there. But just to talk about it on this one, we have mentioned the phone before, but it's now on sale in the UK. Good luck trying to get one if you haven't already, though, because Carphone Warehouse said that demand for this was something like 10 times more than any flagship phone that's ever been released or something like that.
Right. And it's not super duper cheap.
No, it's 50 quid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you compare it to other phones in this dumb phone market, it's so much more expensive. The specs aren't anywhere up to scratch. It's purely trading on this name. And I think Jeremy said that it's basically a £20 Nokia 150 that's been taken to a shopping centre and been given some fancy clothes.
Yeah. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of marketing. I was walking down Oxford Street the other day. You know, Oxford Street's for those that don't live in the UK, it's one of the busiest high streets in the country. Shops absolutely everywhere. And there's an awful lot of mobile phone shops. And there were people standing outside the mobile phone shops with little placards shouting about, come and try out the new Nokia, buy the new Nokia here. And you very rarely see that for anything other than iPhones and maybe when Samsung brings out a new Galaxy S Edge, whatever.
I mean, it is marketing genius. They've basically, like Jeremy points out in his review, and if you've seen the pictures of the phone, it sort of resembles it. The ringtones are sort of up there. I mean, that was the message.
What? It's just, it's very, very annoying.
It's also not as chunky as I really liked the really chunky Nokia 3310, the original. Mm-hmm. I liked the way that Snake was played on it. My fingers could actually use the buttons. On this one, it can't. What they've done on this one is they've put a colour screen on it, because obviously 2017.
And a camera.
And a camera, which takes some pretty awful pictures.
Yep.
But I think we just need to remember here that this is meant to be a dumb phone. So Jeremy's biggest gripe with this is that it's not a smartphone and it can't be compared to as such. But HMD, who makes the phone, isn't really doing that. They're not trying to sell it as a smartphone. It does claim to have some smart capabilities. So it
Bluetooth.
Can...
Don't mean
that.
That
noise?
Goodness me. That was not one of the Nokia 3310 ringtones.
Message alert of purchase.
I mean, slight flashbacks to when I was at school and people would get a new phone, not necessarily a Nokia, but a phone, and pretty much the only thing you could do on it was maybe play a very basic game or sit at the back of the bus and go through all the ringtones that you've got. And so you just hear this noise and then people playing all of the very, very irritating ringtones.
I mean, obviously the good thing about it is the battery, which has always been a great thing on Nokia phones. So I think Nokia claims that it has 22.1 hours of talk time and 31 days of standby.
Can we get a woo, Matt Burgess?
Woo. That was less enthusiastic.
Yeah, it was more like an owl.
It's the ghost of Nokia's past.
Yes. So
it was really witty for you.
It was. Jeremy's kind of as impressed as you'd expect him to be.
Yeah.
It's a marketing gimmick, but a very well done one.
Yeah. So actually, I spoke to, which takes on a bit of a darker turn, but we ran a feature on wired.co.uk early this week talking about psychology of nostalgia. And whether brands are using this nostalgia to hike up prices to rip us off. And one of the professors in this study said, actually, the reason why there's this massive obsession at the moment with all these retro products, so the Nokia 3310, Polaroids, Nintendo consoles, is because of Trump and because of Brexit. So apparently we want to hark back to a time when we felt safe. So that's why we apparently love these retro phones.
It's overreaching a little bit.
It's a little bit. It does get a little bit dark. But I think, there has been this massive resurgence, so there must be something that's driving it.
Well, we'll find out. After we record this podcast, I'm being forced to go onto the streets of Britain and ask a load of young people if they have any idea what this is, how it works, or what Snake is.
Well, this was inspired by our intern, Alex, who actually, when we were talking about the phone originally, when it was announced at Mobile World Congress, had no idea what Snake was.
She's a young person.
She is a millennial.
Is she typical of the young people of Britain?
We will find out.
We will find out. Stay tuned to Wired for more on that. You can read Jeremy's review, I'm sure, on wired.co.uk if it isn't published already. And you can also, as Vicky said, hear an awful lot more of him rambling and ranting about technology on the new Wired and Ars Technica Gear podcast, which will be coming to our podcast feed in the next few days. Shall we move on from Nokia?
On to space.
Space. Yes, from very, very dumb technology to very, very smart technology. A few weeks ago, I spoke to Alan Stern, who is the principal investigator and principal scientist on the New Horizons mission. And this was the mission that, of course, went to the Pluto system and is now hurtling out far, far deeper in space to photograph and collect scientific data from some of the most distant and ancient objects in the solar system. So I wanted to find out, you know, what are they doing? This thing's still... it's still going. We've got this new target, MU69, this very, very distant object in the Kuiper Belt. But what's... are you still doing stuff day to day? Are you in communication with it? Is it sending back pictures? Because obviously we get very excited when these missions reach their targets. But in between times, there's still an awful lot of work going on. And it turns out that of course, that is the case.
What are they doing? What are they... like, what's... they're not just putting their feet up, presumably.
No, so it's sending back images at a higher resolution of objects in the Kuiper Belt than anything that we can see from Earth or Hubble. And I guess there's not an awful lot of excitement about those objects because they're misshapen rocks. But for scientific research, this is absolute gold dust. These are things that have been in the deep freeze since the very, very beginnings of the solar system. So they're billions and billions of years old, and they're able to analyze that data. And this is a good way of explaining some of the complexities around this. It's a 12-hour round trip at the speed of light for data to get from New Horizons to Earth and from Earth back to New Horizons. So you're waiting 12 hours for any command to come down.
It's a bit like the broadband when the Nokia 3310 came out.
Yes, exactly. In fact, the speeds are probably quicker, but the limitations of the speed of light means that it takes a little longer.
That is incredible, though,
there.
The fact that we can even go that far and get the data, no matter how long it takes. That is incredible.
Yeah.
There's a really fascinating TED Talk, and I don't know if you spoke about this as well, but there's a TED Talk from one of the people, I think it might have been on the Cassini mission, or mm-hmm. one of the NASA missions, where they went very deep into space, where because the time difference was so... because the spacecraft was on a different time difference, basically, because of how far it was traveling and the data coming back, everybody wore different watches. So you wore two watches with Earth time and I think it was another planet's time on as well.
Neat.
So you woke
That's
up
amazing.
At like, whatever time it was. It was very interesting.
Like there's clocks you have in offices where it says London, New York, space.
So one of the things that he was very good at explaining is the challenges of these distances, but actually putting those into context. So when you're talking about billions of miles and flying a million miles a day, I think it is, it's quite difficult to wrap your head around it. So he put it to me like this. So he said, everybody can understand their neighborhood. So if you make the solar system your neighborhood, the sun is, and he's from North America, so imagine sort of a North American suburban neighborhood. The sun is one house away from the Earth. Mars is the next house further from the sun, so two houses away. And one more house, so Jupiter is four houses away from Mars, so six houses from the Earth. So if you think about Pluto, it's 44, no, MU69 is 44 houses down the street.
Wow.
So
just give you a bit of perspective.
Keep adding the houses on and on and on and on, and you're traveling there at a crazy, crazy speed, and then you're going to have to fly past something very, very small at a far shorter distance than they flew past Pluto. And gather that data in a one shot, one chance, and that's it. And that's the only chance they get.
I think he's been on this. Obviously, he's been on this from pretty much the beginning, hasn't he, Alan?
Yeah.
So, he's dedicated his life to this, And I always think that with these NASA missions, that people dedicate their absolute career to one particular thing. And it's like with the whole 69P, when it fell over, there's people who have decades of their life to this.
They were graduates when they joined the missions, yeah. And now they've got wives, husbands, children.
PhDs, all yeah. sorts, yeah. yeah.
It's absolutely incredible. But what's really interesting about the New Horizons mission, other than the sort of groundbreaking discoveries that it's making at the edge of the solar system, is that everyone thought, oh, well, Pluto, now we're done with that. Well, they've gone, well, we're going to identify another target, MU69, this Kuiper Belt object. They want to know, does it have rings? Does it have moons? Does it have an atmosphere? Is it geologically active? And we just don't know these things. With Pluto, we had some ideas that it was of a certain colour and a certain size and a certain shape, and it had an atmosphere and it had moons. But with MU69, we have absolutely no idea. But even when it gets there, because they've been very, very clever with how they use the fuel, they'll still have enough left, potentially, to go after one last object.
Which is?
They don't know.
Oh.
So they deliberately picked MU69, one, because it's an object potentially of interest and it's the kind of thing that they wanted to go after, but also because it allowed them to get there using very, very little fuel. So they'll still have enough, they reckon, to keep the mission running for maybe another decade afterwards, to go after one last target, and then New Horizons will just be sailing completely out of the solar system and off into interstellar space after Voyager 1 and Voyager 2.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, so it's, as you say, it's a lifetime's work. But for this mission, it really is. It's 30 years, I think, between when it launches and when it completes, when it runs out of fuel and they can no longer communicate with it.
It's been a bit of a rollercoaster ride for Pluto itself in that time, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, it used to be a planet.
Now it's not a planet.
So I learnt my very early morning jam sandwich usually nauseates people. There's another one that's less irritating. My very easy method for... I can't remember. No, my very easy method makes... Anyway, mnemonics, right?
Yeah.
And when Pluto went away, we all had to learn a new mnemonic, or not. I just knocked off people. So there's this big debate. Should it be a planet? Should it be a dwarf planet? And for all the team that are working on New Horizons, Pluto should be a planet. It is an incredibly...
This is what Alan thinks. Alan thinks
it is an incredibly interesting active body. And he makes this very eloquent point that in science, you don't make decisions on a vote. You make decisions based on evidence. And this was a decision that was made on a vote, which is very, very unscientific. So he's urging people in the scientific community, and he's been on this campaign for a number of years now, and hopefully the New Horizons mission will finally help to punch through some of the misconceptions. It's a planet. Don't have a vote. Look at the scientific evidence, and we can go back to my very early morning jam sandwich, usually nauseates people.
Don't tweet me, basically.
Exactly. So you can read my interview with Alan Stern on wired.co.uk. He's a really interesting guy, and his mission is absolutely... Well, it's remarkable. He's also going to be speaking at Starmus, which is an astrophysics and science conference in Norway, which I'll be at as well. So hopefully I'll get to meet him in person, because this was over the phone down a very crackly line. He was in New York at the time.
Norway seems like a good place to have a space conference.
Does it?
Why?
Well, not.
It's near a space, isn't it?
Does Norway have the Northern Lights? Or is that... Am I completely wrong?
Well, if you go north enough. Yeah.
That's what I mean. There's a connection in my head, at least.
There's a link to space in Norway.
Make your wooing noise and we'll go on. There we go. Next story this week, our third story this week, is perhaps one of the stories that people will have read on a number of rival publications. It was broken by The Guardian. This is the news of Facebook's moderation policies, and The Guardian has been leaked about 100 documents, I think, relating to how Facebook moderates its users and everything that they post.
Yeah, so this came out, it was almost a week ago now, it came out on Sunday, which feels a long time ago, but I think that it is something that's really interesting, and that what has actually been provided to The Guardian is around 100 internal documents. There's a load of spreadsheets, there's a load of files and images that all relate to how Facebook is controlling or moderating its users and what they post online. And I think, just to put this in context, why I imagine somebody leaked this was because there's been a lot of controversy in recent months, years, about what Facebook does and doesn't allow. That last year it didn't allow the Vietnam War photo, which was an iconic, I think, a Pulitzer Prize winning photo.
Yep.
From the war, until, well, it blocked it because of nudity, I think, was it?
Yeah, it's an image of a girl who's been burnt by
by napalm
running naked down the road screaming, which ran on the front page of newspapers all around the world back in the 1970s. But Facebook decided, and we've covered this before on the podcast, Facebook decided no, that's child nudity, and it banned the image. It started blocking the journalists from the newspaper, I think it was in Sweden,
yeah,
that were trying to post it. It took down a post, I think, from the Swedish Prime Minister, mm-hmm, and it all got a bit out of hand before someone saw some sense and went, hang on a second.
Yeah, and yeah, that was just one of the examples from recently. There's also been lots of questions raised, and we've talked about on the podcast before, about Facebook Live and people sharing graphic content, sometimes tragic content where people are killed, and a lot of stuff that is, a lot of people would say, is unsavory or not necessarily they want to consume from a platform that they're going on to talk to friends or something like that. So these files give us a bit of a snapshot into what Facebook, what the staff that work for Facebook are told around what is and isn't allowed, and where they should sort of draw the line. So a lot of the things here are hugely complex issues, and sort of the people we spoke to around this story were saying that obviously people use Facebook and social media in different ways in different parts of the world. So what might be acceptable for us to share here in the UK might not be acceptable in Japan. If you take your business card example, that
cultures are different all over the world, and as you say, it's an incredibly, incredibly complex issue. And essentially, Facebook is having to moderate humanity. It's got users in every single country in the world, bar China and North Korea, you'd imagine. Billions of posts being put up every day. How do you deal with that? And it turns out you have set lists of examples of the kinds of things that you're allowed on the site. And what was very interesting about the documents that The Guardian got was this was the first time in a long time, some of Facebook moderation stuff has been leaked in the past, but this was a number of years ago. It's the first time in a long time that we've seen how Facebook's brain works, if you like.
Yeah, and it's probably worth pointing out that these are probably always updating guidelines anyway. I'm sure if you remember a staff who joined 6 months ago, they wouldn't be the same as the documents they're using today, because this sort of thing is obviously always evolving. But within the files that The Guardian had, just to give some examples, one of the things that should be blocked and removed is if somebody posts the message saying someone shoot Trump, that should be deleted. But in contrast, to snap a bitch's neck, make sure to apply all your pressure to the middle of her throat, that can stay.
And it's these, when you boil it down to those statements, and you have on the document they have a little tick and a little cross next to them, it seems baffling as to how they can make these kind of decisions. But they've got to make a decision somewhere, right? They've got to draw the line over what is appropriate, what is inappropriate. And people have been critical of Facebook censoring things that it shouldn't have censored and almost being too prudish. They don't allow fully exposed breasts, for example. So pictures of breastfeeding mothers, they'll get kicked off the site. Whereas, okay, so if someone says your comment that you read out there about snapping someone's neck, well, should that be removed? Would it be prudish for Facebook to remove that? The context of that post, who it's directed at, it's incredibly complicated. So I don't think in any of the coverage of this, The Guardian or ourselves have been especially critical of Facebook. It's a realization of how complex the issue is, and maybe how ill-equipped it is to deal with the kind of content that is being posted on its network and the speed at which it is posted.
And the thing is, a lot of these moderators are humans. They're not done by computers. So There's people whose job it is to watch pornographic material, child porn, abuse, all those sorts of things, to make sure that it ticks or doesn't tick these boxes. That's why I think we refrain from being really critical on this, because that's someone's decision that has to sit in an office and watch those videos, the beheading videos, for example. They have to sit and watch those, which is just awful.
Yeah, and our colleagues Wired in America, it was published in the UK version of Wired, but I think in the over time it's disappeared from our website for some reason, but you can still read it on wired.com. It's a fascinating story about the people, as the headline put, that keep dick pics out of your Facebook feed. And this is a subcontracted group of people in the Philippines that, as Vicky says, spend all day looking at horrible, horrible things on Facebook and just click yes, no, yes, no, and in certain instances have to call a manager. And they're seeing the very, very worst of humanity, so that we continue to view this quite oddly algorithmically but also human filtered view of the world. And you kind of forget that when you see these things appearing in your newsfeed, but the documents that The Guardian got its hands on were a very, very good reminder of well, Facebook is still relying on people to see the worst of humanity in order to make an awful lot of money.
Yeah, and I think for me, a lot of this is about how people are, well, it's really complicated. I don't think anybody is necessarily surprised that Facebook has these documents and policies that are around violence, terrorism, child abuse, because of course they do. I'm sure Google has got the same type of documents for what they allow in search engines. We've obviously got laws that don't allow this type of stuff as well. So I don't think it's a surprise that this sort of thing exists. It's just the publication of this gives us a little bit more transparency around what is and isn't allowed, and that's what is a really interesting thing for me about how much power does Facebook have to censor certain things. Should it be something that Facebook decides, or laws decide, or society decides? Could there be a system that we set up where there is some sort of, I don't know, I'm just riffing off the top of my head here, some sort of controversial post or some sort of controversial message where people all vote on that as a society and say, is this good, is this bad? Obviously that's got its own issues, but is there, it raises questions, are there better ways to do this as well? And obviously people say AI, but it's nicer to know what Facebook is doing and what it isn't doing than actually it just being a black hole where you don't know what happens.
Well, Roland this week went to the Oslo Freedom Forum, and he spoke to Opera, the browser, the founder who helped co-found Opera, John Van Tichen, and he was saying about how actually he thinks that, aside from other things, he thinks that web tracking, for example, should be banned. Facebook and Google shouldn't be allowed to do that. But one of the quotes he says in there that was really interesting is he said, we need to be careful about how we look at fake news. Because as soon as you start controlling one sort of news, whether it's fake or not, you are then censoring. And it's that censorship thing. And that's what always Facebook comes back to, is that they have that really fine line between making sure that people are safe, making sure that people don't see this offensive content, without being that media organisation that censors the internet. And with its power and its reach, that is a really significant thing.
Yeah, and it all comes down to accountability. This is, I think, the issue that Facebook is dancing around, and an awful lot of the commentary on this story is dancing around, is that Facebook is making editorial decisions. It is making moral judgments on what is okay and what is not okay. And those decisions are changing how people view the world. And we've seen very real demonstrations of that on how Facebook has been used to influence political events and the way that people react to news, and even, to mention it briefly, the tragic events in Manchester, social networks that were used to spread fake information about people who had gone missing. These platforms are being gamed in very, very dangerous ways to make people think in certain ways. And having accountability over how Facebook and Twitter and Google handle the moderation of humanity is a hugely, hugely complicated problem. So does it go to a vote? Are there laws, as Matt says? It's something that we're only just beginning to grasp. And it's going to take an awful long time, I think, for legislation to catch up with these very, very fast-moving technology companies. But it is of great credit to The Guardian that they're able to get these files, put them out into the public. And while there might not be a great deal of public interest in this, I'm not sure how well the stories that The Guardian ran did, how much interest there was in them. But it will start debates in political circles. It will start debates in think tanks. It will start having an impact on how people view these companies and view the way that they behave. And hopefully that can be a force for good.
Good thing, yeah.
Vicky, you mentioned it a little earlier. This week, Oslo. No, not Oslo. Roland. This week, Roland.
Roland
was
Mapplethorpe, which is what some post said the other day.
Really? Yeah. He does have a lovely name.
Rowan Mapplethorpe.
Rowan Mapplethorpe. Makes him sound even more grand. So earlier this week, Rowan Mapplethorpe was at the Oslo Freedom Forum. He describes it as a global gathering of human rights activists, sometimes called the Davos for dissidents. And he spoke to three activists using technology to fight power and prejudice. One of them, Evan Mayoweri, is a pastor and leader of the This Flag movement in Zimbabwe. You can hear an awful lot more of this on Upvote, which is Wired's new political podcast. But here's a clip of Roland's conversation.
In 2016, April of 2016, a day after independence celebrations in Zimbabwe, I recorded a short video, 4-minute video, lamenting the state of our nation, Zimbabwe. And I used our national flag in that video. And I spoke about how our nation has gone so far from what this flag actually means in terms of the different symbols in it, and that the distance between what this flag means and where the nation is just so far, and calls for every Zimbabwean to get involved in closing that gap, and for Zimbabwe to once again be a nation that we can be proud of. And so this 4-minute video went viral, and thousands of people and then millions of people saw this video, and a lot of people began to talk about this flag in Zimbabwe and how we need to rebuild again and how as people we need to be part of that journey. Well, that little video turned into 25 videos that I then did after that, one every day, calling on Zimbabweans to rise up and to get involved in building their nation. Unfortunately, our government did not take too lightly to that approach, and I was arrested. As I was arrested, thousands of people rallied for me at the courts in Zimbabwe demanding my release, and I was released. Upon my release, I fled the country with my family to put my family in a safe space. And once they were safe, I made my journey back to Zimbabwe again. And on arrival in Zimbabwe in February, 1st of February 2017, I was arrested at the airport and charged with subversion. I am still in custody as we speak. I am out on bail. My passport has been seized. I can only access it by applying to the High Court and stating where I'm going and what I'm going to do over there. So this trip, actually, I said to them I was going to Johannesburg, and then, of course, ended up coming here. But that's how I've gotten involved in this. It wasn't a plan. I was never going to be an activist or a human rights defender. All I set out to be was to be a Zimbabwean who wants to be proud of Zimbabwe. That's all I want. And so that's how my journey has begun. That's how I find myself here amongst amazing people that are doing amazing things to change, to change the fortunes of the people that, you know, that in, that they represent.
For more of that, listen to the latest episode of Upvote. To do another plug, Wired also has a new Gear podcast hosted by Jeremy White and Mark Walton from Ars Technica. You can check that out next week as well. Podcasts, too many podcasts.
And at the weekend, we're going to be publishing a story about how to create award-winning podcasts after we spoke to the guys from My Dad Wrote a Porno.
There you go. Podcasts are in. So enjoy them all. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.